The Lab takes the ethereal to the practical. Our podcast acts like a business school case study for private equity professionals, CEOs, operating partners, and chief transformational officers. We all know transformation is the key to differentiated alpha. Here's how you actually do it. Our audience tunes in to learn from those in the field, getting their fingernails dirty and driving meaningful growth through better operations, technology, and data. We learn from going to business school, teaching at business schools, and applying these lessons in the real world that case studies actually help the insight stick better. Come join us.
Hey, all, and welcome to the next episode of the podcast here, the Lab Podcast. Nick and I are excited to connect with Josh, and we'll let Josh dig into his background a little bit. But one of the things, he and I got connected from his long tenured experience in global manufacturing and technology, where those all overlap. And you know what he's, well, I'll speak about Josh in front of him, but one of the areas he punches above his weight is thinking about turnaround and growth. And so, you know, turnaround can have lots of meanings. Sometimes it means fix it, it's broken. Sometimes it means turbocharge that growth. But, you know, growth's often the hard part of adding value. So, you know, we're going to dip into this a little bit, and maybe we'll let Josh give some of his background and, you know, why he's had success in helping these sorts of, you know, turnaround and growth companies within manufacturing and technology succeed.
Thanks for the introduction, Scott. Happy to be here with you guys. I'm a fan of the podcast. I love the things that you and Nick get into on it. And I'm really excited just to have the opportunity to share a little bit of my experience as well. So thanks a lot.
Great. Well, one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, how do you add value? Add value can be in the C-suite, which you've done. Add value can be in the board, which we're talking about. And so, you know, as we're thinking through, and you know, if listeners are also thinking through, geez, how do I get involved in PE-backed asset? It's usually going to be around, you should be creating some value. Surprise, surprise. And so, you know, love to sort of dig into your thoughts around how you got interested in turnarounds and how you're applying that, you know, going forward to, you know, various assets that, you know, that you can work with on behalf and with private equity firms.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, great place to start for the discussion. Thanks for that opportunity. I'd say the way that I got interested in the turnarounds, I could only classify that as not by design, actually. It's like a lot of things in life that end up becoming really valuable or adding a lot of wisdom or something. It's nothing you ever set out and you plan to do, you know. I studied mechanical engineering when I was in university and went into what I thought was going to be a pretty normal process engineering life. And I think when I see it now and look back on it, I realize that, you know, the experience that I gained in turnarounds, it kind of come as a result. I'm sure there's some certain aspects of my personality that helped kind of draw me into that. You know, I'm a pretty curious person by nature. I like really difficult challenges. And I mean, I love people. I love to be around people. I love to help people. And most of all, I love seeing people prosper and grow. And I think those things probably kind of helped me gravitate to those kind of situations like turnarounds because, you know, honestly speaking, they're pretty high risk. But then there's also a lot on the line for the people involved. And those kind of things really, I think, what got me motivated in it. And apart from that kind of motivation, what I can say is, you know, the industry I was a part of, you know, it's manufacturing and a pretty specific subsector of that. And it was really in a constant state of restructuring from the early 2000s. That was largely due to large parts of the production, the sales of those things moving offshore, particularly to Asia and specifically in China. And it left the entire industry just in a state of trying to rebalance, you know. And at that time, I was a pretty young middle manager. I was working across different factories in North America and Europe, and I had a lot of great opportunities just to be involved in, you know, all the nuts and bolts of doing a turnaround, not really in building and planning it, but in executing it. And, you know, what I learned at that time is those, a lot of the turnarounds that I participated in, they were always with some level of success, but I started seeing these patterns appearing where the same problem just started repeating. You know, maybe 1 year later, 2 years later, companies right back in a difficult situation and trying to build up this next Herculean style project to, you know, reset the company and put it on a sustainable path. And really what I started realizing at that time was there were some things emerging that were just, I think, lost opportunities. And those lost opportunities were the things that were causing this repeating pattern. And I just kind of told myself, you know, look, if I ever get a chance to do a turnaround and lead one, then I'll take all of these amazing experiences that I've got from the executives that give me the chance to participate in it. And I'm going to see if I can make a difference.
Well, that's kind of what we're talking about here is the lessons learned, right? I mean, you talked about sort of there's an emotional element to it, right? Normally, when you think about turnarounds, you know, the fixing part of turnarounds, you can think about, you know, a knife or a, you know, an instrument to sort of be emotionless, right? But your point is actually, you know, it's the emotion part of it that is important. And, you know, when you're sort of dealing with unfortunate and uncomfortable situations like layoffs or whatnot, understanding that emotional part of it is good. You need the technical capabilities, but maybe some of those lessons learned for others, people, if they have to go through it, because, you know, offshore manufacturing is not going away, right? I mean, it comes back and it goes away. But, you know, so any thoughts around, you know, hey, listen, I wish I knew sort of then what I know now in terms of being prepared to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to jump in on that. You know, I think the great thing about the experiences that I learned is, I'd say, it's not sarcastically, but they, my best experiences, they don't come from the successes you have. They come from the things you don't do very well, right? You just learn and you evolve that into some form of wisdom. And that type of wisdom, when you implement it later again in life, it's so much stronger and more beneficial is my experience. And so, you know, I think the simplest way I could kind of paraphrase that is, you know, the same things that you just introduced, Scott, all of these, what are, I would say, are the technical components of building a turnaround, right? Are the things that you could very easily sit down in a classroom, academic environment and explain, right? You know, you got to do all of these kind of points. And what I really realize is, you know, they're essential to the turnaround, but they're not the key. You know, doing those things well, it has to be done. You know, as an example, taking a look at, if you had a business that's not doing well, you really need to sit down and study deeply what the problems are. You know, trying to understand from the cost side, from the revenue side, and then all those components that are going to come after it. You're going to identify your levers, try and figure out which ones you can pull and what the effects are going to be. And you're going to try and get your team centered around that and go through your actions and the follow-up. Really essential, but really important, but not essential is what I want to say. And what I started realizing in my experiences is I'd kind of put those things in a classification. I'd call them the foundation of the turnaround, right? But really what I realized is the things that are underneath that are really what, for me, were able to drive this differentiated alpha that you guys talk about a lot. You know, how am I going to be able to get the performance of something up above, you know, where it is typically for everyone who's doing it? And that part I call the sub-foundation. It's something I can explain to you a little bit of what I think is most important. But really, in my experience, building a really good sub-foundation, it's going to give you this great ability to, let's say, excel and bring the performance to a level that's better than what you expect.
Well, let's get into that sub-foundation. You know, one thing that I just want to call out in some of our prep for this is why we believe your perspective is so valuable is because you touched on it, but you were in the management layer, right? You were the one that was having to execute on these tough, tough challenges, thankless work in a lot of cases. And it sounds, from my perspective, never being in that world, it's almost survivalism, right? And we'll get into it later about, you know, action rather than, you know, being paralyzed by overthinking things. But let's talk about that sub-foundation, because I think it builds on the IQ-EQ juxtaposition that Scott and I have talked about a couple times with other proven leaders.
Absolutely. It goes exactly in that direction, Nick. And I think really for me, if I was trying to generalize the sub-foundation, it starts off with exactly what you said. It's talking about these skill sets that you have as a human being, which are, you know, sometimes categorized in this IQ and EQ, and trying to apply that. And the challenge for me really came in that area, actually, when I was in that middle management layer and trying to be one of the doers of a lot of these tasks, is that first I found out, you know, really what I would say is you had to start accessing this level to get to that EQ level in those situations, because like you said, it's pretty high stress and it's pretty demanding. You got to find a level of vulnerability and courage that you're not used to using in manufacturing, right? And that's tapping into those emotions and those feelings and using it as a part of your guide for decision making. And I'd say, you know, it's a pretty big challenge, I think, for most people in business, because for at least in my case, for a lot of my career, I was counseled completely to the opposite of that you know, you needed to put your emotions aside if you wanted to make decisions that were going to be best for the business. And, you know, in all of the experiences that I've had in my life, I think that's simply just not true. You know, you need to use all of the skills you have at your ability and available to you to try and do the best you can in those difficult situations.
Well, let's touch on that real quick. Vulnerability in the type of environments that you were in, that's challenging, right? Like it's hard to see the human side of really anyone when you're in chaos. So I'm imagining that's a learned skill. So do you believe your expertise is really born out of having to be at that management layer? So now you can take that up to the board level and be able to reflect back what has worked for you in the past?
You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but it's probably true what you say. Yeah. Because what I can't, speaking from, you know, if I'm trying to elaborate in my own words on what you just said, you know, there's a number of times when you're in that layer, that action layer in that middle management, when you're going to be pressured to do something that maybe you don't think is the right way to do it. And somebody's given you a very specific way to do it. And what I realized at that point, you're right, is finding the courage to object to it is probably one of the harder things to do. But once you do it, then the second time it gets a little easier. And the next time it gets a little easier. The next thing, I think when you take that into the leadership level, it probably does. Yeah, you know, it gave me a much better understanding of what the teams might be thinking at that time. You know, and what kind of problems they're going to be going through when I'm asking them to do the same things.
Yeah, experience only comes from experience, right? So it's nice that, to your point, you're able to do that. And, you know, which leads to one of the things that we've been talking about when, you know, when we're talking, and let's change the names to protect the innocent, but when we're introducing you, for example, to private equity firms that around opportunities and assets that we collectively think are interesting, and we're saying, here's a way to showcase, you know, Josh's ability to be a strong manager and or board member. Any advice you'd give to someone who's going to be in your shoes that says, here's how you can best deal with private equity firms? And when I say deal with private equity firms, it doesn't mean they're, you know, a bunch of mercurial animals, but it's different when there's a PE professional, deal professional, and an operationally minded executive. So any thoughts on that from a, you know, best practices standpoint?
So, you know, in dealing in the case of the turnaround, or just like, say, dealing in your work you do with private equity in general?
Yeah, any which way. It's sort of like, how do you navigate that for the first time if you haven't been navigating PE-backed opportunities?
So I can, in a generalized statement, what I can say is, you know, if I was giving advice to anybody about their life experiences and their professional experiences, it's just, if you've been through those challenging circumstances, you know, and even if you think you've done poorly and you didn't feel like you were as successful as you wanted to be, trust me that there's a huge amount of lesson in life you've learned in those things. And then when the next opportunity comes around, in this case, as an example, now having the opportunity to talk with some private equity companies, you know, it gives you a much different set of clarity when you're looking, for me, in my case, looking for opportunities and things that I think you can drive value in. As an example, if we go back to this idea about turnarounds, right? I'll outline for you today, if we have time, you know, four key points that I think build up a sub-foundation that really, in my experience, makes the success, both short-term and long-term, of a turnaround much more sustainable. But really what I realize is that, you know, this innate experience you're gaining, and you don't realize you're doing it at the time when you're going through some of those difficult parts of your business life, is that you're gaining a level of insight and clarity that other people are not. You know, and so as an example, after I had led the first turnaround that I did and had an opportunity for the second one, you know, I'd say actually most of the opportunities that I accepted, I think most people would have walked away from because they thought it was going to be a guaranteed failure. And they just, but for me, the risk probably was equally as high, but I could see into it with a depth of clarity that it took away all of my fear. Said, no, I think there's ways to solve this, and I could see into it more deeply. And that kind of skill set, which was just something that I've developed from being inside of real problems and kind of getting into the details of it, now I can turn it around the opposite way, I think, like you said, Scott, when you're talking with the companies and trying to imagine what could be done to create value, you have this ability to kind of, not x-ray vision, but to see more deeply into it than someone who doesn't have those experiences.
Yeah, so let's go backwards, because I think the whole point of this is to give listeners the practical, you know, takeaways that they can actually use. So what is that sub-foundation, so to speak? Because I know you've outlined a couple of them, and I love it.
So you're right. Yeah, thanks for that, Nick. It is really, again, coming back to that EQ, IQ thing that you guys talk a lot about on this podcast. But if I was trying to summarize it in the simplest way, I'd say it's four key points. And my advice for anybody, if they're attempting a turnaround or getting ready to do one and they want to improve their chances of success, is take these four key points that I'll try and outline and explain and develop it with your leadership and the team that's going to perform the turnaround. And my idea would, and the way that I've used it actually, is just turn it into almost like a team charter, something that you're going to use to help guide you through this process. Because, you know, these, I don't know if you guys have had a chance to, or if you have any statistics you can cite. I tried to do some searching, you know, before the podcast today and see what, you know, what the, what's the success ratio of a turnaround. And from doing some internet work, I can tell you, I could only come up with something in the neighborhood of 20 to 40% is the success ratio. I don't know if you guys know if that's an accurate figure or not.
Well, I mean, just to chime in, but then we'll get to the specifics. The what we quote in, you know, in the classes we teach at Columbia Business School is that 2/3 of these transactions are destroying value. So all of us that are involved in M&A and these turnarounds, and like most of the time, it's not successful, which was sort of the impetus of having you on and others to say, well, geez, that's a pretty bad math equation. So, I mean, let's talk about this foundation, because it should be some number north of 50%, which it's not. So, you know, I'd be curious, how do we sort of make that, you know, a success rate higher?
It's exactly what I exactly. Well, thank you for that. It's a beautiful segue, because my feeling is, in the best case scenario, imagine if a turnaround's 50-50, then you're talking about a flip of a coin is basically the level of success ratio that you can achieve with this. And so these type of things for me have allowed me to bring consistently a level of success that's much higher than that, much, much higher than that. And so really, again, what I would say is take this sub foundation, build it with your teams, and it should be made up of at least these 4 points. The first one that I think you have to include inside a sub foundation is sit down with your team and set your guidelines for how you're going to handle adversity. And what I mean by that is, you know, how are you going to behave when it gets tough? Because it is. It's always going to get tough when you're doing difficult work. That's the purpose of it, you know. And how are you going to react when something goes wrong, or when a key member of the team does something that you think is, you know, a mistake or a failure? You know, how are you going to support each other in those moments? Sit down with your team and define that and get it to a point where you guys can all understand each other that this is the way we're going to have this is the way we're going to work. It's a cultural frame of mind, right? And it's, what are you going to do when it gets tough? Because it's easy to be supportive and positive when things are going well. And that's not the time to talk about that. And then the second point, which I really think kind of each of these are going to kind of segue into each other, these 4 points for a sub foundation. Second thing is make sure it's very clear to the team. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to fail, you know? And I'm not saying that you're trying to encourage doing the wrong thing, but really what you, in my experience with turnarounds is when you've got a pretty, let's say, motivated and heartfelt team, you know, that are performing and working with you, every time you make a mistake, it feels like, and it did for me at the personal level, man, I've just done something that's going to crash the company. You know, I'm going to be the reason this company fails. And you need to set that frame of mind for the team that, no, look, the reason we're doing a turnaround is because the company's already in a really difficult situation. If we don't take some kind of actions, then it's a foregone conclusion what's going to happen. And so letting the team know that taking risk and having it go wrong, it's not a failure, and you're not the reason the company's not going to make it out of the turnaround. You know, and you have to be able to give that, again, that kind of point of view to the team and help a frame of understanding so that they're going to know how to execute it again when the things get a little bit difficult. And then the third point I would say that's really critical for me is prioritizing action over accuracy. You know, and this is something that it may not, I'm not saying just go out and do anything you can think of without even giving any thought to it, but very sincerely, just make sure you prioritize actions over accuracy in your day-to-day work. And really the point behind that for me, it's about teaching the team how to take risks and how to open up and watch and see what happens when you introduce something new into the business equation, right? And I can say in my experiences as well that action, more often than not, it's not the solution to that you're going to apply long-term to solve the problem. But teaching that behavior, what it does do is it opens up kind of this creative process that most times is going to get you exactly to that solution that you really needed. It's going to make a big difference for the business. And if I was being very practical about a turnaround, if you kind of imagine, you know, a V-shaped process or a U-shaped process, I would stick with this type of behavior is for sure in the way down, all the way to what you would think of as the rock bottom of the business. And even when it starts to turn around a little bit, you know, at least through that phase of your process, stick with this idea of action first over accuracy. And then to be even a little more specific, in some instances in my life, when you get to a point when you're cash flow positive, you've got a small positive EBITDA, and you've got a little bit of breathing room, then you can think about adjusting the situation and be a little more thoughtful in your strategic actions. But you know, in my experience, until that point, keep the team focused on taking risks and trying things. And then, you know, the last real point of this sub-foundation is really just going to kind of combine those three things that we've talked about. And it's a lot of words, but I'll try and simplify it also. It's take care of the emotional capital reserves of the team. And what I mean by that is, you know, for me, emotional capital, it's kind of, I think it's what creates the motivation and that desire and drive within the people that want to do the things they're doing. And when that's depleted, I'm sure you guys have had instances in your life when your emotional capital is depleted. And it's not the easiest thing in the world to get yourself up out of bed and take on difficult challenges in those phases, right?
Yeah, it's usually on one of the days of a podcast, but you know.
No, never that. But I think this part's so important, and it goes back to your first point about how are we going to deal with adversity. And right, you're setting your guidelines right up front, open communication. You're asking people to try. This whole thing builds on itself perfectly, and I think it's wrapped up very nicely with the emotional capital piece.
Yeah, you're right. You know, Nick, one of the things I failed to do is a great example of setting your guidelines for adversity. You know, and one of the examples I have in my life is we set a rule: no negative comments when somebody makes a mistake. We're going to talk about it. We're going to try and understand it, and we're going to try and transition.
My kids would love you.
Yeah, me too. My kids are probably calling me a hypocrite right now. How to transition those mistakes into wisdom really fast. You know, that was one of the rules we had. But so emotional capital reserve. So really for me, this is the most important dry powder in any type of difficult challenges, because if the people aren't motivated and engaged, you can't get it even with the perfect equation. And so the point here for me is, and when we're thinking of it, you know, as an asset and as a reserve, you need to save enough of that in the team after you've hit rock bottom, and now you got to climb, essentially, you know, metaphorically climb the company on its way back up. You know, that's one of the most difficult points. It's never a straight line. You know, nothing in business is ever a straight line like that. And you need, in my experience, you need that reserve and that motivation to people for when you hit these road bumps where things fall back down. You think, ah, crap, we're going right back down where we were.
And you mentioned this in our prep, but like, I think this is where one of the big pitfalls comes in, and you learn this in your management days, but this is where, you know, the leadership of a company, the board type decisions, the budget cuts, the layoffs, if they're in the pitch with you and communicating with the team, that makes the rest of the survivors, so to speak, at least feel like they're being led by people who have skin in the game, right? And I think that probably is often overlooked.
Yeah, you're right. My advice to any leadership team and executive team and ownership team is get as involved as you can in these details. You know, it's an extreme show of respect to show that you're caring, concerned about how any of these changes are going to be made and implemented. You know, and I think it's really also, it's a good way to keep the team motivated. And, you know, I think when we come back to this final point of this emotional capital, it's the same thing. If you're the leader of the turnaround, you know, if you take care of the team and you see how they're doing personally, and you follow them through those difficult times, you know, it's not going to be a core metric in anything you're ever going to explain about the fundamentals of a turnaround, but it is essential in order to, let's say, achieve, I think, the end result. And in the examples that I've had in my life where I've done the best at trying to preserve it, you know, once you get to that rock bottom and you start to climb out, it ends up becoming like gasoline on a fire. And the thing just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes because you've got the people with the energy they need to do the right things.
How do you think about, you know, we were talking about a turnaround that leads to growth, but the front side equation is, you know, the Charlie Munger margin of safety. Like, there's companies that need turnaround. How do you think about this one is too far gone and this one has legs? Any thoughts on, you know, because if you're going to get involved on the board or you're going to get involved as a C-suite operator, you know, you got to be able to pull some levers from historical muscle memory and scar tissue and experience that you have. So how do you decide if it's, wow, this has, I can do this, or I'm going to pass on this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. I can say in my career, I've never been involved in a turnaround where, let's say, the key to success was some fundamental of the macroeconomic environment, right? Or the business itself. I mean, I've been in, like I said, I'm coming from an industry that was in a constant state of restructuring because of reducing sales volumes, right? But there were still constant opportunities to succeed in a market like that. And I was around and, say, participating in one turnaround effort where, in my opinion as well, I, I saw that I thought there was no chance of recovering it. And it was pure culture. The working culture, the motivation culture, and the communication culture had gotten so bad that I think no part of the team was able to work together well. And so implementing any kind of a change was immediately just, you know, just completely unsuccessful and irrelevant. And that would be the thing. If you walked into a situation where the culture was completely wrong, right, and you were trying to decide if you really wanted to get invested in it or not, you just need to know that's the most significant thing to change. That's going to be the most time-consuming and energy-expensive area of it for you.
It's hard because you can't put culture in an Excel model, but, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast, as they say. So, well, listen, I mean, this is great. I mean, obviously, we've enjoyed working together, and we're excited about all these different opportunities we're chasing down, and we're partnering with private equity to sort of drive value. So, listen, Nick and I are excited. It's been awesome to spend some time with you and dig into particulars. And, you know, the team charter of these four key points, as you say, it's nice because it's hard to do that because it's again, it's more EQ than IQ. So we appreciate you spending some time with us today. And, you know, hopefully others will find it valuable and they'll, you know, step in one less landmine or whatever as they, you know, proceed on their path.
Yeah, I'm happy to have the chance to share that experience with you, Scott and Nick, as well. Thanks a lot. And you know, the only small closing thing I'd say for you guys is that if in the people that you reach out to or that touch this podcast, you know, if any of this stuff is resonating with you, you can contact Nick, you can contact Scott. You can find me through LinkedIn. You can get in touch with me. And I'm happy to give you 30 minutes of my time for free just to talk about your situation and share my insight because I know it. The end result of those things going well, it's going to make a positive difference for people. And that's a great thing for me.
Yeah, well, you're kind to do that because I would say that's in the minority of folks that are, but that's what makes you good at what you do. So you know, hopefully they'll take you up on it.
Yeah, guys, wish you the best going forward. I love what you're doing, and I hope to see it just continue to go and go and go.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, guys.
I hope you guys enjoyed that. It was nice to talk to Josh. I have not done extensive work, believe it or not, in turnarounds. Obviously, oftentimes private equity firms are helping. You know, when you talk about growth a little bit, but we didn't get into growth turnarounds all that much. What's your experience with it? Because from the outside looking in, it seems like a tumultuous challenge, and it sounds like there are a lot of there's the human emotion, there's the financial challenges. What's your overall experience with it?
Well, I view it as sort of two sides of the balance sheet. There's the debt side and the equity side, right? So sometimes turnaround, it's like, hey, listen, the equity's wiped out and the debt's trying to get as close to 100 cents on the dollar as possible. So can we? And sometimes it's actually, if we turn this around, there'll be some equity too. So one of the things I appreciated from his comment was, how do you decide to even get involved? Is there enough juice to make yourself whole on the debt or equity and or equity? And so it was interesting to get his take on, you always hear that culture is so important. It's just hard to quantify culture. And so getting someone like a Josh involved, you know, there's lots of great firms out there that do this, but, you know, getting someone involved to say, this dog doesn't hunt, or actually, you know what? I think if we do A, B, and C, we can get a return that we're looking for.
Yeah, you called that out, the culture piece about it doesn't show itself on a spreadsheet. And when I did a lot of conversating with Josh before the recording, he kept going back to how important the culture was, how important the vision of the leadership, because look, they're down on their luck. They're trying to turn this around. Do they have what it takes? Do they have the grit? Do they have the tenacity? Do they have the vision to actually fix it? I can imagine from a PE perspective, this is probably something. I know there are operating partners who sole focus is just to deal with people, right? And understand if the right people are in the right seats. And that's where Landcorp, I mean, you guys are constantly looking for the best and the brightest to put them into types of companies like that, right? I would imagine there are a lot of Joshes out there that could be beneficial for the unseasoned either PE team or operating partner team that has experience or even companies just going through this. And again, I don't think you want to do it by yourself because it sounds nasty.
Yeah, exactly. Well, like anything seems, everyone wants to be rising tide raises all ships, right? So in theory, you'd rather be involved in something that's growing like crazy, right? But, you know, listen, you can make money lots of ways. So Everyone's got their different courses for different horses.
Yeah, I love rhyming. All right. Well, hopefully you guys enjoyed that. We will be back again. You know, I think we're getting a little bit of momentum here. Maybe we're on a little bit of a turnaround here. We got people interested in the podcast, talking to us. We got guests lined up. So it was all your vision, Scott.
Well, I think I view it as growth. I don't think we're not in the bottom of a U.
No, we never were.
Always exactly. Up and to the right. Always up and to the right.
That's it. All right. We'll be back.
See you.